Wherever in the world they run, trains and the rails they travel along signify one of the most powerful and profound human ambitions of all time. The building of the railroads had a profound effect on the history of our country, and trains continue to be a favored mode of transportation around the world. They're also the subject of today's edition of Please Explain. And joining us now are John Hanke, an independent scholar, historian, and railroader who served the B&O Railroad in a variety of capacities, including company historian, locomotive engineer, and curator of the B&O Railroad Museum, and Bob Lettenberger, the Director of Education for the National Railroad Museum, which is located in Wisconsin. I'm very pleased to welcome them to Please Explain, and reminder to our listeners that you're welcome to join in the conversation either by giving us a call at 212-433-9692 or by leaving a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. John, let's begin with you. Take us back to the beginning, which may be much further back than most people realize. When did people first start thinking of creating grooved rails or roads for wheels to travel along?
I think like the crank or a lot of other basic technologies, the idea for the railroad is much older than kind of whatever manifestation it must have taken. Probably the earliest example would be in ancient Corinth on in the Mediterranean, where the Corinthians cut grooves in a stone pavement to guide carriage wheels back in classical Hellenic times to move warships from one side of the Isthmus of Corinth to the other.
Not all that different from what we have with the Erie Canal.
It was the same kind of, I think, basic idea. And the Romans used grooves cut in pavement quite often to help guide chariot and wagon wheels in certain locations. That was all lost during the Middle Ages, pretty much. And the in Germany, mainly, what is now Germany, in the Middle Ages, miners deep underground began making crude tramways that would guide wheels. So this is very much an evolutionary technology. No one invented the railroad. It kind of grew over hundreds of years in Europe in its modern form.
And were miners using these tramways all over the world after the Germans came up with the idea?
Much, much later. The idea of the railroad migrated to Great Britain, and in the 17th and 18th centuries, mostly in the coal mining regions, they used tramways extensively to the point that by 1800 there were well over 2,000 miles of very crude but very effective tramway, kind of the prototype of what would evolve into the modern railroad later.
Bob, when was the steam engine invented? Well, I would assume that's when horses were replaced.
Well, I think that if you look at steam engine, and as John kind of noted here, this was another invention that really was an evolution. Thomas Servais back in 1698 came up with the basic crude idea of a steam engine. In fact, we already talked about mining uses. The first steam engine was actually used to pump water out of a mine. When we think of it in context of our conversation, we need to jump to England, the early 1800s, and Richard Trevithick taking the developed steam engine and applying wheels to it and putting it to crude rails. At that point, we begin to see something that starts to look like a steam engine that we would eventually know and use here in America.
But that was also designed to carry coal, not passengers.
Well, by the early 1800s, and as John noted, we're into that era where we start to see things develop into what we know today. And really, when you get to about 1825 in England, the Stockton and Darlington Railroad begins not only to carry coal for mining use, but also general freight and then also passengers. So we're seeing it's much like a lot of inventions. Once the ball starts rolling, or in this case the wheel attached to a steam engine starts rolling, the development picks up fairly quickly and things moved along as we envision new uses for this technology.
In a recent issue of the New Yorker, Malcolm Gladwell wrote about the difference between inventors and tinkerers, innovative thinkers who come along after a big idea has taken shape and make key changes, contributing to the evolution of a product or industry. In the case of railroads, it sounds to me like it was all about tinkerers.
There were some inventors. We could say, for example, that George Westinghouse really had the big idea for the air brake, which is what made modern high-speed railroading one of the things that made it possible. But yes, most of the time these are, we could call them very talented tinkerers.
Well, Matthias Baldwin, who built a locomotive that ran on coal instead of wood, that's a major change.
Well, a number of folks actually had that idea simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in railroading, as in so many other technologies, we're dealing often with simultaneous invention and a kind of parallel process of development here and in Great Britain and in Germany and other places.
Well, can you tell us a bit about New York's West Point Foundry, which assembled the country's first steam and locomotive that had been imported from England as a kit in 1829?
We didn't have much industrial capability then, and West Point Foundry, up opposite the U.S. Military Academy at Cold Spring on the Hudson, was actually intended early on originally as an armament plant, and because it had skilled craftsmen who knew how to work metal, because it had machine tools and kind of the know-how, the Delaware and Hudson Canal and Railroad Company, when it ordered a British locomotive in 1828, had it sent to West Point to be assembled and tested. And the folks at West Point saw an opportunity there and then began building locomotives as best they could. The next one, for example, was called the Best Friend of Charleston, the first locomotive to really successfully run in North America. And after that, they built a few more locomotives. Their real time was during the Civil War making armaments, but they were influential in the early locomotive development.
Today we're talking about trains and railroads on Please Explain with John Hanke and Bob Lettenberger. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lope. Bob, we say railroads in this country. Other people say railways. Should we make that distinction?
Literally interchangeable. And in fact, that's a discussion we often have here at the museum. Is it railway? Is it railroad? And it seems that the European citizenry likes railway. We have adopted railroad in our country. And if you even look to, say, the 30s and 40s and 50s here in our country, there were a lot of roads that their corporate name was either railroad or railway. So I think here in the U.S., relatively interchangeable, but we're leaning toward railroad, per se.
We tend to think of the shape of this nation as inevitable, but I gather that the idea that the continent could be traversed by rail really changed everything, including how people imagine the development of this nation stretching from coast to coast. Can you talk about how the railroads and the idea of transcontinental railroad really shaped who we have become?
Well, I think you have to start by separating the technology of the railroad from the idea of mobility. The U.S. is pretty well characterized by people willing to travel and relocate, start new lives, migrate. If you think that most of the early Americans, leaving aside the Native Americans who were here first, had already come from somewhere else. They were kind of predisposed to keep on moving. It was never a sure thing in the early years that the U.S. would remain one country, and in fact, we're celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Civil War beginning this year. What the railroads did in the 1840s and 50s is give people a tool. For the first time, they could envision actually a nation stretching from sea to sea and a way to get around within it that was economical and efficient and effective. And where that most visibly, I think, comes into play is in the creation of the state of California. The discovery of gold suddenly gave us a real stake in hanging on to the other side of the continent. So the railroad was kind of the one tool that solved all sorts of problems for the United States in the 19th century.
Well, the gold was discovered in 1849. The railroad didn't reach coast to coast until 1862. So it was quite a while afterward. What really motivated people to finally create a transcontinental railroad? Was it because of the fact that the Civil War also broke out in 1862?
It's really about politics. The idea of a transcontinental railroad goes back to the 1830s, almost the beginning of the railroad era itself. But it's a big country, and it took a while to sort of marshal the capital and the political will and survey the routes. And it was an awfully big project that, in fact, had to be undertaken as kind of a joint public-private enterprise. And we'll leave aside the incredible corruption and the mismanagement and all the things that sort of characterized business in the 19th century. But what happened was the beginning of the Pacific Railroad, the actual beginning of construction, was tied up with the expansion of slavery. And once the Civil War began in 1861, then it was possible for Congress, with the southern states having seceded, to actually pick a route, charter the company, and get the whole enterprise underway.
A listener, Meredith, asks, was the construction of railroads in the 19th century a public-private partnership? How much of each? And are there similarities to the debate today about public-private partnerships to address our needs for job creation and a renewed infrastructure, which includes railroads, by the way?
It was a public-private partnership before the Civil War. Then we made a pretty hard turn towards totally private ventures. But there has always been a pretty close relationship between the government and the railroad industry for a whole variety of reasons. And I'll point out that the Erie Canal, our first really big and successful internal improvement project, and the National Road were government projects. So we have a long history of debating this and not knowing quite where we want to come down on it.
Leonard, and something else I add to John's point here, I think in that time period following the Civil War, when the transcontinental railroads were being built, and then on into the early 1900s, we kind of saw an ebb and flow, love and hate relationship between government and public and the railroads. You know, when you look at our railroads, beyond the political concerns that John cited, it was really also a matter of speed and that staying connected. And the railroad was the next big jump in our country to make the country smaller, if you will. And because of that, people loved the railroad. They wanted the railroad in their town so that they could be in the loop. After the railroads came through and we started to see some of the robber barons take advantage of the situation, the pendulum swung completely the other way, and that relationship with the government went to regulation to try to tame the railroads. And I think now you're seeing it swing back the other direction to people again realizing the railroads are a good thing, and if we have proper partnerships, as you noted, potentially with high-speed rail and further development of passenger today, the railroads are a viable transportation partner. So you go through the time period, and it's love hate, and it's on who's on which side of the relationship to really understand things.
Although there are states that are actually rejecting money for high speed rail on political grounds, there is a new series on AMC called Hell on Wheels, and in it the railroad mogul punches his engineer who is setting the track straight across the plains, because he says he gets paid for each mile and he would prefer to have the whole thing as curvy as possible to add to the mileage. Did that actually happen?
Yeah, some of the land grants, especially on the building of the original Transcontinental Railroad, the land grants and the payoff in mortgage bonds was established by how many miles of track were completed and accepted by the government. And there were cases where very circuitous routes were taken to lengthen a line. One of the more famous ones, and early on in the building of the Union Pacific, was the Oxbow incident, where about 20 extra miles of track was built west of Omaha just to increase the mileage, where today that line is literally straight, completely bypassing the original route.
But I'll point out that really was small beans. These fellows were inventing American big business. They were very, very smart, and they found breathtakingly effective ways to skin the public treasury.
So. We're talking about Cornelius Vanderbilt, Jay Gould, Russell Sage, and people like that?
Yeah. much of the crowd, many of those folks were honest, they were sincere, they were building the country and building companies. But then you had the, I guess like today, the folks who just saw their main chance and were going to take it no matter what.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we invite your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. The topic on today's Please Explain is trains and railroads and the future of railroads in America. I also want to talk a bit about train travel in Europe, which can be a lot more pleasant and is often seen as a viable alternative to air travel, less so in this country. My guests are John Hanke, an independent scholar, historian, railroader who served the B&O Railroad in a variety of capacities, including locomotive engineer, company historian, curator of the B&O Railroad Museum, Bob Lettenberger, the director of education for the National Railroad Museum, which is located in Wisconsin. Start calling now, 212-433-9692. We're back with Bob Lettenberger, the director of education for the National Railroad Museum, and John Hanke, who is an independent scholar, historian, and railroader who served the B&O Railroad in a variety of capacities. We are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Before we get to them, maybe I can eliminate a few of the questions by asking the kinds of things that people do think a lot about. It seems to me that the era of train travel was biggest, at least in the 20th century, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, when trains had names like Silver Streak, and people would travel across the country. Even recently, a friend tells me she used to go to Columbus, Ohio overnight. It was it didn't take any longer than driving, and she loved it. And all of that seems to have been eliminated.
I wouldn't say it hasn't been completely eliminated, Leonard. We still have Amtrak in our country that is designed to provide inner city rail service. Yes, it is a shadow of what we had in the early part of the 1900s. In fact, the actual peak of rail passenger travel in our country was the early 1920s, and with the exception of World War II, has been in decline since then.
Because of the automobile?
I would say a good portion of the automobile, good portion airline as well. You know, when you look at the period right after World War II, let's say the 1950s, we have a mass of GIs coming home who have been bound by military rules for a long period of time. We have a highway system that is under development in our country, and what better freedom than to go out and travel when you want to go. And we start to see business and society catering to that highway culture, and we have gained a freedom. We've broken away from railroad time, if you will, and have learned to go on our own. And that really began to spell a downturn, the end, if you will, for passenger travel from our glory days in our country.
But we don't see the same sort of thing in Europe. In fact, China is building high-speed railroads. But I just recently vacationed in Europe and went from Amsterdam to Paris and then to Brussels by train. It was quicker than if I had taken planes. People regularly go from Rome to Florence. It takes about an hour and a half. Madrid to Seville, about an hour and a half. We don't see that sort of thing here. You mentioned Amtrak. The Acela is incredibly expensive. It's often delayed. It doesn't have any of the amenities that you find in those European trains.
You can almost see these as two mirror approaches. In Europe, they were much more accustomed to a kind of central planning or coordination or public policy, so that from the beginning they emphasized sort of a broad social good, a broad network of railroads that emphasized passengers, not freight. We voted with our feet and wallet over here, and whatever system was most efficient and least expensive, that's what we put our eggs in that basket. So that you could say that our freight railroad network and our interstate highway network is the envy of most of Europe. their passenger rail network with supporting buses and trolleys and streetcars is the envy of our passenger. You know, we envy that as an almost ideal passenger transportation network. And you have to consider the scale. The U.S. is just so has so many wide open spaces. Our cities are generally widely separated that for us, the airplane and the automobile just represented better transportation solutions.
Listen, let's take some calls. We go now to Jim from Bricktown, New Jersey. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Yeah, I was curious. I've read that the rights of way that were issued for the original railroads would not be possible to be available or offered, and that it would be prohibitive, and aside from the scale of the country, that it would be prohibitive for us to have a high-speed rail because of the rights-of-way issue. They would comment on that.
Is that a problem, right-of-way? It wasn't in the past, was it?
Well, I think there's a couple of things, and here I think is let's kind of set one thing out about high-speed rail and really what we're talking about. At each particular speed increment, as we move into higher speeds, 79, 110, 125, 150 miles an hour, there are certain requirements for the right-of-way. At a certain point, you can no longer have grade crossings. Your right-of-way needs to be fenced in. You need certain types of signaling systems. And with the way our rail network is structured in the country today, we are looking at, in some cases, being able to use existing trackage and upgrade it. Or in some cases, it may maybe like the situation in California, where they are attempting to develop an entirely new right-of-way. So, you know, the direct answer to our listener's question, think about going through some of the territory in the East that is heavily populated and carving out a strip of land to run a new high-speed rail corridor. That's going to be a pretty tough task. And so when you're looking at a lot of this, it's a matter of how can we efficiently use existing rail corridors to meet safety requirements and also make it economically feasible.
Let's go to Larry from Bayside. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I was wondering if there can be a greater separation between the commercial-style freight trains and the passenger trains. If you look at the Long Island Railroad, it's basically a 19th century train that's been electrified. So the trucks and the superstructure of the train is massively heavy. It takes a tremendous amount of energy to move them. This New York City subway system is the same idea, where you're using 100-year-old technology to move people. Couldn't we have new trains that are lighter and more efficient without having to go to something like maglev and the science fiction future?
The Federal Railroad Administration spends a lot of time and effort trying to figure out that very question, and there are elaborate rules in place to separate freight and passenger traffic. A lot of the problem comes with who owns the tracks, whose interests are being sort of represented, the freight customers, the shippers, the passengers. In Europe, they make many of their passenger trains much lighter, and their freight trains are even much lighter. But we've always sort of tended towards overbuilding here in the U.S. So I guess the short answer is there's no answer, but a lot of very smart people worry about this all the time.
Thank you for your call. George in Queens asks, when it comes to delays and failures, is often due to signaling. Why is it so hard and costly to maintain and upgrade the signaling given today's technology and engineering?
Well, I think you're looking at a system that is spread literally over hundreds, if not thousands, of miles. Excuse me. And with the tendency for use of computer technology and global positioning and things of that nature today, the railroads have consolidated or have attempted to consolidate their dispatching, the people who are actually controlling the track and the trains, into centralized locations. Obviously a cost savings measure there. And when you're talking about an intricate network that is literally spun over hundreds, if not thousands, of miles, you're going to have things that break down. and you know it ranges from just wear and tear to vandalism to you know things as simple as Mother Nature getting in the way sometimes. And if you look at signaling though in our country, it has dramatically improved over the decades, where if you were to pick a spot today and go back, you know, 50 years, we would see an incredible improvement. It just happens that when we as people are inconvenienced today, well, what do we blame it on?
Well, I guess you don't ride the New York City subways very often. My guests are Bob Littenberger and John Hanke. We're talking about trains and railroads on today's Please Explain, and we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC, or you can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Larry from Brooklyn asks, why aren't monorails more widely used? Are they cheaper to build, and aren't they quieter?
I think they seemed like a good idea at the time, and the infrastructure is just so massive and so complex, and just moving trains from one track to another is complex. It's a fine thing for an amusement park or a World's Fair, but in real life, it just really doesn't work that well.
Others have asked about trams and light rail. Are they a good idea for urban transportation? We see them a lot in Europe. Is it too late in this country?
Not hardly. In fact, a good deal of the development that is being done in urban areas these days is in the form of light rail. The commuter system in and around Dallas, Texas, they're building an extension to that service. They have just ordered several new high-capacity, low-weight vehicles for their extension. Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota built a spur to connect their downtown with their airport, and they're expanding that service as well, and that is all a light rail, lightweight vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
So it all goes really on what is the application that we're going to be using it for, and playing into those rules set up by the government as to what the cars have to be able to do safety-wise to run on certain tracks.
Ron, hi, you're on the air. Ron from Smithtown.
Hello, and a great show. Happy holidays. What did Robert Moses do to dismantle the railway system, especially here in New York, when he put all the money into the infrastructure of highway and the rail, maybe 20% of the surplus went into the railroad?
Now, Robert Moses also is reported to have vetoed a plan to add a place for light rail on one of the new highways. Was that just the thinking of the time, or is he a particularly egregious example?
I would say he's a wonderful example of what we now would say is misguided thinking or kind of selfish thinking, but it's all part of a piece. He had a vision for the city that largely did not include rapid transit or railroads as we would know them today. So he opted in favor of other things.
Steve from Comac, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. Great show. I've always enjoyed listening during my lunch hours. Now I got a chance to ask a question. Regarding gauges, I'm not sure if you discussed this. I already got involved halfway through the show. But did we discuss the standardization of gauges and how the United States benefited from that at the time the railways were developed through Europe? I understand there were a lot of gauges that were not compatible, and as a result, they had subsystems and subtrains that were not able to go very far because of the incompatibility of gauges. Where the United States had gotten involved later on in the development, I understand they benefited from a relatively more standardized gauge.
Yeah, you're bringing something up for the first time.
Well, let me start this off, and then, John, I think you can probably finish it fairly well. You know, here in the U.S., we did have a number of different railroad gauges. We were not always set on 4 feet, 8.5 inches. When you look at railroading in the U.S. during the Civil War, this is one of the reasons that the North did better with its railroads than the South. There was a greater variety of gauges in the South. The North had already begun to standardize, and hence railroads in the North were a lot better. And then that idea carries on that eventually 4 feet, 8.5 inches did become standard throughout the country.
And let's put this into a slightly larger context. Throughout most of the 19th century, we did not have any kind of reasonable standardization. We didn't have standard time zones. We didn't have standard screw threads. We didn't have standard pipe sizes. We didn't have standards for much of anything. So it's part of a drive to a much greater degree of compatibility and interoperability and standardization in general.
We've talked a bit about how the rail service has gone into decline in this country, partly in competition with automobiles and planes. But there are 300 credible railroad museums in the United States and Canada. So people still find this a very romantic subject. And I remember working with a guy who left WNYC and was excited because he was becoming a conductor on a railroad. So are we still very ambivalent about this?
Well, I think the first thing to do would be to recognize that the freight railroad side is doing very, very well.
Yes.
It's become a very prosperous industry that has reinvented itself from the inside out over the last 20 or 30 years, which then leads to a likewise prospering railroad heritage community with museums and model railroads and toy trains and all sorts of wonderful historic preservation projects.
Well, we have to leave it there, unfortunately, but I thank the two of you so much for being on our show, Bob Lettenberger, the Director of Education for the National Railroad Museum in Wisconsin, and John Hankey, an independent scholar, historian, and railroader who served the B&O Railroad in a variety of capacities, including company historian, locomotive engineer, and curator of the B&O Railroad Museum. Thank you both so much, and thank you all of you who called in.
My pleasure.
Been a pleasure being along this afternoon.